One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
This podcast contains explicit language.
So that happened. This week, we are happy to have one of our old Huffington Post colleagues on the show for the first time, author and journalist Mark Lamont Hill. Mark has a new book out called Nobody, in which he traces America's state-sanctioned war on its most vulnerable citizens, from Ferguson, Missouri to Flint, Michigan, and beyond. He joins us to talk about how much America has learned about itself since Michael Brown was killed, and whether or not forces are emerging that might achieve a more perfect union. Meanwhile, the 2016 Summer Games in Rio de Janeiro have kicked off, and if you're enjoying watching the competition from the comforts of your own home, you may want to think about doing everything you can to prevent where you live from becoming a host city for the Olympic Games, because it's becoming increasingly clear that when the Olympics come to town, people lose their homes. Maybe the Olympics are just bad for us. Finally, we are marking a sad chapter in history this week, the two-year anniversary of the genocide of the Yazidi people in Iraq at the hands of ISIS death cultists. We're joined by the Kurdistan Regional Government's representative to the United States, Bayan Sami Abdulrahman, to find out how the Yazidi community is rebuilding itself and whether or not any progress against ISIS has been made since then. I'm Jason Linkins with Huffington Post reporters Akbar Ahmed, Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Travis Waldron. We'll have all of this, plus we'll try to explain what it was that Donald Trump thought he was doing on the campaign trail this week. But here's what happened first. Hello, America, and the rest of the world watching America for signs that we are slowly killing ourselves. Welcome to another edition of So That Happened, your weekly digest of everything that's political and nonsensical in our world. I'm Jason Linkins, host of, well, the editor of Eat the Press. I'm joined, as always, by my lovely people, Arthur Delaney.
Hey.
Hey, Arthur. It's good to see you.
Thanks.
And Zach Carter.
Hi, everybody.
Welcome back, Zach Carter.
I know. I'm in Washington, not Philadelphia this time.
Yeah, that's right. So we're all here and we've had like a little bit of time to digest the conventions and now the race moves to its new stage less than 100 days before Election Day. And there's a little bit of an open question now if maybe Donald Trump actually doesn't want to be president.
He's had quite a week saying things. You know, you're used to Donald Trump saying crazy things that are not true. But, I mean, he has asked the Russian government to hack Democrats.
His political opponent.
That's old. What's your favorite thing from this week?
This relentless and pointless attack on the family of Khizr Khan, I can't believe that it just keeps going.
It's not to be fathomed. The way he has like come out against party leaders like Kelly Ayotte, like Paul Ryan, like John McCain, has suggested that he would not support their reelection bids and support their primary opponents, which is really nuts. But can I tell you here's just something that a lot of people maybe didn't miss. Jordan Sargent from Gawker wrote about how Donald Trump did a campaign appearance in Loudoun County, Virginia, which is very close to here. And I grew up near Loudoun County. Loudoun County right now is a very, very wealthy county in America. And it's gotten really rich on the fact that government and military contractors and their families all live in Loudoun County. It's like white collar to the core. It's very wealthy. It's McMansionville. All those people are doing great. And Donald shows up and, as Sargent put it, acted as if Loudoun County was a desiccated Rust Belt part of America and was like, your economy is doing terrible here. Your factories are closing. He went on to cite a number of factories that were not in Loudoun County, one of which wasn't even in Virginia, that had closed. One that was near Loudoun County did close, but it closed 8 years prior to Donald Trump showing up to complain about it.
Yeah.
And the gathered people were completely nonplussed because these are all like polo wearing preppy guys who are like, living in giant houses on tiny postage stamp lots.
Two kids and a golden retriever.
Yeah, exactly. And to be told by the Republican candidate that they're doing lousy and that they should be factoring in factory closures that took place miles from their homes was just like insane.
Well, the entire premise of the Trump campaign is that America is in shambles and only he can fix it. So even and a lot of his supporters are doing fine, but, you know, they're with that message.
Yeah,
I just think that's a message that would have made sense in southwestern Virginia, in coal country, a lot more so than it does so in sort of the northern Virginia exurbs of Washington, D.C.
It's a message that would have made sense in a detective comic book from the 1980s.
I mean, you know, it's not the case that there aren't communities that are in real trouble whose Trump's message resonates. That is the most awkward sentence I've ever said.
That's the amazing thing.
That is true. But it's also not the case that these people, that in order to win those people over, you need to go around attacking members of your own party or the family of a dead war hero. It just doesn't, you don't need to do that. And it doesn't effectively get your message across that you're going to help these communities. It just shows them that you're an asshole.
The Gold Star families were the most offensive thing where, you know, he's impugning these people who lost their son, who served this country. But I think the thing that was craziest that contributed to a growing commentary on Donald Trump's sanity this week was his continued bashing of fire marshals.
Which is amazing.
Right. People who don't hold partisan positions.
Right.
Who work with the Trump campaign in advance to set a limit on the number of people who can come into a hotel ballroom or whatever. So when the limit gets reached because the Trump campaign itself over-distributed tickets, Trump then singles out the fire marshal and says it's a conspiracy of Democratic fire marshals to suppress the size of his crowds.
I had no idea that fire marshals were an important Democratic Party constituency.
They're not. I mean, one of the the fire marshal he criticized in
big
Ohio.
Big fire marshal. Big fire safety.
Yeah, in fact, the fire marshal he criticized in Ohio was a Republican. So he's done
and
this.
Didn't the fire marshal actually rescue him from a stuck elevator right before he criticized him?
In Colorado on Friday, yeah. So three times in a week, he did this. It continued into this week, and it's just so pointless.
It's campaign shtick. It's like, that's his way of saying, oh, I'm so popular, not all of you could fit in here. The guy won't let you in.
He could do that without attacking the guy. And sure, he's like he can be funny, but he doesn't do it like it's a joke.
If he doesn't
funny.
Attack the guy, there's no dominance play involved. There always has to be a dominance play involved with Donald Trump. That's
you're right.
Something that Josh Marshall has picked up on quite readily and is really quick to articulate whenever he does it. It's a dominance play. There's no Donald Trump can't have just a peaceable kingdom.
Right. Know? Like in that interview, that Loudoun County, in an interview around that time, he also said he was asked about Paul Ryan and he said, are you asking me for a quote on Paul Ryan? And the reporter's like, yeah, I'm interviewing you right now. I want to, everything you say is a quote. And he said, I'm just not there yet. He had this line ready because that's what Paul Ryan had said a while ago about not being ready to support Trump. So it's a grudge he's held this whole time, and he's just pointlessly rubbing Paul Ryan's face in it now.
And it's amazing because after all of this horrible shit that Trump has done, attacking veterans, attacking fire marshals, because Paul Ryan and the other Republicans that Trump insulted did not disavow him during those comments. Once Trump then attacks them personally, it makes them look really small if that's the last straw. Oh, you're going to attack war heroes?
Yeah.
Okay, fine. But you're not going to support my reelection? No, that's it. I'm out of here.
This is Washington, man. That was always going to be the last straw. Everything's acceptable as long as there's an opportunity for a shameless opportunist to exploit. When you fuck with Paul Ryan's money, though.
So none of these guys are going to withdraw their endorsements now, as some people seem to think might happen. Donald Trump's not going to withdraw from the election, as has also been talked about. But he is feathering the bed for the most favorable loss by saying the election is rigged. That's another weird thing he keeps saying. He keeps denigrating the integrity of,
it's not weird.
Of our democratic
process.
It comes
right out of the GOP playbook. I mean, I think that that's something that has always been said, that
No, it's not.
That's why the constant focus from the GOP is on voter fraud and, like, excluding people from...
the opposite. That's an effort to actually suppress voting.
I know.
We're talking about the integrity of the votes, the system itself, after...
Yes, well, the argument for all these voter ID laws is that there's no integrity in the voting system.
Oh, but it's made so half-heartedly it's such a naked effort to keep black people from voting.
Right, yeah, of course.
Everyone knows that's all it is. And so Donald Trump is saying the election's rigged. He's got his buddy Roger Stone saying this, like, every day on InfoWars.
Yeah.
I think because they rightfully anticipate that he won't win and he'll want to be... complain about.
Now, post-convention, Clinton has posted some gaudy numbers in polls. She's up by 10 in a couple polls, including the Fox News poll, which you wouldn't ordinarily think would be, you know, probably still has a bit of a Republican House effect to it. But at the same time, still rather close in some important swing states. Even in spite of all of this, in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Florida, if you're the Trump campaign, you still figure you have a shot, provided you campaign there.
And note the down ballot poll numbers for people in Senate races, right? Like particularly in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, which are some seats that Democrats really want to pick up if they have any chance of taking back the Senate. You see people like Pat Toomey and Ron Johnson actually doing quite well, pulling far ahead of Trump. So it's not clear that even if Clinton can squeak out a victory in those states, that it will have the sort of like wave election type impact that Democrats are hoping for.
So I have one more question. One of the things we talked about on the show before, we've had Thomas Frank on to talk about it, is that with Hillary Clinton as your titular party head and your presidential nominee, there's always been this kind of like suffocating focus on the needs of the professional class versus the needs of the working class and the middle class. And, you know, post-convention, we see a strategic choice by Clinton to go out on the hustings with the very, very richest people in the world to campaign on her behalf and say Donald Trump is a bad billionaire. We've seen Michael Bloomberg,
Warren Buffett
at the DNC. Warren Buffett did a campaign appearance. Mark Cuban did a campaign appearance. And most recently, Meg Whitman has said she'll support Clinton. When you were at the convention in Philadelphia, did you find that there was an too intense focus on professional class and affluent voters? Did they ever get to really forming a message for people who are not just part of this Democratic constituency that's always been doing well in the economy and is always making it?
I was really fascinated by the number of attacks on Trump for making his clothing line in other countries. That is not explicitly a disavowal of TPP, big trade deal that's currently in the works. But it was a populist play. It was not there were not a whole lot of there just weren't people in the crowd who were like really, really jazzed by like Mike Bloomberg's speech that he gave at the convention.
I rather think that speech was projected over that crowd to centrists sitting at home.
The delegates at the convention, even the diehard Clinton supporting delegates, were not people who were out there thundering to like get more Romney voters in here. So the convention it did not feel like it was orchestrated or an attempt to play to that audience, really. Even in the later days of the convention, when they did have Mike Bloomberg come on stage and effectively say that Trump is bad at being a billionaire. I think Clinton's message so far since the convention that's over has largely been to shut up and let Donald Trump light himself on fire in front of everybody, which means she's capable of being super vague about whether what I thought was quite a very progressive speech that she made on the convention night, the last night of the convention. She can just be sort of vague about whether she's going to follow through on that stuff for a while, because what are you going to do? You got cable news showing Donald Trump doing the dumbest, meanest things constantly.
Yeah. Well, I think there's like just sort of maybe inherent risk about appearing too many times on the stage with people like Warren Buffett. I understand the play. understand the play, but I also understand that this campaign at some point has got to start relating to people, especially in the swing states I mentioned. All right, Zach, Arthur, thanks for talking about this. We have a really nice show, so please stick around. There'll be more good show, and we want you to hear it.
More good show.
More good show.
More good show.
We will be right back.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
And we're back. This is Arthur Delaney. I'm joined by Jason Linkins.
Hey.
And we have a very special guest, Mark Lamont Hill. He's a professor at Morehouse College, an award-winning journalist and author, a CNN commentator and a host on BET and VH1, and a former Huffington Post colleague.
The best Huffington Post colleague.
And he's got a new book called Nobody, Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable from Ferguson to Flint and Beyond. Mark, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, man. I miss you guys. I miss talking to you guys every morning at Huff Post, man. That was the best experience. Even Zach Carter.
We know.
For those who don't know, Mark is referring to Huff Post Live, where we were all we would all be Mark's guest.
Yes.
And be schooled on the news of the day.
It was great. It was great. It was. I'm sure you look back on it, Mark, as like the pinnacle of your journalism career.
Oh, that's exactly right. That's exactly how I look at it. You hit the nail right on the head.
Yep.
Tell us about Nobody.
Nobody. It's a project I've been working on. I actually started it right as I was at Huffington Post, and when we were at Huff Post and we were covering everything that happened in Ferguson in 2014 of August, I went down there and I spent a lot of time on the ground, and I decided that I wanted to tell a deeper story about what happened in Ferguson, because I realized that the story of Mike Brown wasn't just a story of Darren Wilson shooting him. It was a story of a kid, like many Ferguson residents, who had been, whose well-being had been compromised by a school district in Normandy School District, which was, one of the worst in the country, and, public housing, which had really collapsed in St. Louis with Pruitt-Igoe, causing people to move to Ferguson. It was about Emerson Electric, the factory there that closed down, leaving people basically jobless. All of those things made Mike Brown's life hard much before he met Darren Wilson, and I wanted to sort of think through that. What does it mean for a town of 20,000 people to have 16,000 out of the 20,000 have warrants open, and to have tickets and other sort of civic penalties, such that the town business is not manufacturing. The town business is basically ticketing people.
Yeah.
And so all of those things help contribute to why he's on Canfield Green at that moment where Darren Wilson shoots him. So I wanted to tell that story. And then lastly, as I was writing the proposal for the book and I was beginning to write this book, we were right back in New York covering Eric Garner and, the non-indictment of Daniel Pantaleo. And next thing you know, we're in Baltimore talking about Freddie Gray and Hempstead with Sandra Bland. And before I knew it, I realized that this wasn't just a story about one city that had kind of rendered a kid disposable. It was about an entire country whose fundamental infrastructure at the level of housing and education and the criminal justice system was really undermining everyone's sense of prosperity. This very idea of democracy is compromised by the system itself, and so I want to tell that story.
Yeah, the book, you bring a great historical sweep to the story of what happened to Michael Brown, and I want to talk about that. In the first chapter, you draw this amazing contrast between two of the highest profile incidents of the last 8 years. There's the killing of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson. Like 6 years earlier, there's the Obama Beer Summit with Henry Louis Gates and the white cop who'd arrested him for trying to open the front door to his own house. Tell us about those two things and how you've put them together in your book, Nobody.
You know, I think the contrast is so significant because, you know, part of what it means to be nobody is to be rendered disposable. And without a doubt, you know, race is a key piece of this, right? Black people tend to be rendered more disposable than others and their white counterparts, to be sure. You know, it's hard to imagine the tragedy in Flint with lead poisoning happening in Grosse Pointe, Michigan.
Yeah. Right?
But then there's also this question of class and the way in which our understandings of class and how it's performed also shapes how people respond to us. So, you know, when Henry Louis Gates gets stopped by the police and the president himself says that the police behaved stupidly. This is a guy who never intervenes and makes commentary against the police. This is someone who, at this point, had never really made any significant racial commentary since the what I call the Philadelphia Compromise speech, where he's about Jeremiah Wright prior to being elected.
The supposedly wonderful, famous speech.
Right, exactly, which was bizarre at best. Yeah, and he's not speaking out against, you know, the killers of Sean Bell, where he said, well, let's respect the jury's decision. It's not the kind of, you know, speech against Trayvon Martin being killed. It's a speech against his homie from Harvard. You know, and I love Henry Louis Gates, and I think he's an extraordinary scholar, an extraordinary person. But it's interesting that when it comes to him, this is a sense of this shouldn't happen here. When it comes to him, it's a sense that that the wrong person was stopped, that this type of behavior shouldn't be visited upon someone who is a co-mingler with white society, someone with fancy awards and fancy degrees and who comports himself in a certain way. But the truth is that this type of behavior shouldn't happen anywhere. But when it's a Cece McDonald or a Sandra Bland or a Katherine Johnson or a Maya Hall, we don't have that same response. If it's a Rekia Boyd, we don't have that response. And so for me, the class difference here is significant in the way we respond to it, because the vulnerable aren't just black people. It's people who are marked as other and people who aren't seen as deserving of access to democracy, people who have been erased from the social contract, people who don't fit in the public imagination when we talk about citizenship. Those are the people who we have to be very careful about, particularly in the era of Trump, right, where certain people are being erased very, very literally from the social contract.
So I want to. You also write quite a bit about Freddie Gray case and the way the Freddie Gray case is prosecuted. You raise some interesting concerns about it that I think maybe speak to the whole way that figures who achieve a sort of elite status get to signal and behave versus those who don't. By now, of course, the news is that, you know, the people who are originally indicted for various crimes related to Freddie Gray's death are all going to walk. In your book, you kind of go over that moment where Marilyn Mosby first took to the microphone to explain what she was going to do in response to the case. And it was something that I think most observers who were either inclined to support Gray's family, the black community in Baltimore, looked upon quite favorably, but you had misgivings. Could you explain some of those?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Like, and we were all there at the presser, or we watched the presser when Marilyn Mosby stood up. None of us expected her to say she was going to prosecute all six of them that quickly. And, you know, it was just an impressive moment. She became like a hero in Black America overnight. You know, and everyone was applauding her, and she had memes, and we were all excited about it. And to be honest, I'm not as critical of Marilyn Mosby per se as I am of a system that allowed that to take place in the way that it did. I think what Marilyn Mosby did was principled. I think she was courageous, and I think she had the best of intentions. I mean, we could debate about whether or not people were overcharged or whether or not maybe two of the cops should not have been charged at all. I mean, these are kind of in-the-weeds debates that experts can have. But I think the more significant question here is not whether or not Marilyn Mosby prosecuted these cops, because I think she should have indicted them and that they should have been prosecuted. I think the question, though, is what does it mean for prosecutors at this moment in history to have this kind of unilateral power? Even if she used it properly this time, that's not the most people who are on the business end of prosecutorial power are black, and it's not to get justice for them. So I think that, you know, there's a bigger issue here. We live in a moment now where most cases are not decided through trials. They're decided through pleas.
Yeah.
And because of mandatory minimum sentencing, the prosecutor now has much more power than the judge, because the determination can't be made by a judge to offer leniency. So it really comes down to what the prosecutor charges. So now you have a prosecutor. We haven't gotten rid of the arbitrary and capricious nature of sentencing. We've just relocated it from a judge to a prosecutor, which is very dangerous when you don't have the kind of adversarial system between prosecutor and public defender that we used to have, because the public defenders themselves are now kind of co-opted by the same system. Not because they're bad people, just like the prosecutors aren't bad people, but because the system itself is so dysfunctional. So you have contract attorneys, for example, public defenders, who are overworked so much that they have to outsource the labor to private lawyers who now get a contract to represent all these people. And if you get a flat fee to represent everybody, the money's not in good representation. The money's in getting through as many cases as possible.
Yeah.
So the market logic prevails.
Mark Lamont Hill, I think this gets to a broader point that you make in your book, which some people might mistakenly think is a book about Black America. You talk about intersectionality and how these are much broader problems than ones that only affect African Americans.
Absolutely. This book is a problem. This book is as much about the crisis of white supremacy as it is the crisis of capitalism. You know, we right now live in a neoliberal moment where the market becomes the ultimate decider, to use George Bush's language, of what's good and what's bad. The notions of deregulation and austerity and the quote-unquote free market, which we know obviously is the fair market, all of these things lead to a certain kind of economic reality where the private good trumps the public interest. And then it's not just an economic issue or material issue, it's also a cultural issue. So what neoliberalism breeds is a sense of individualism, a sense of I. It's the individual I over the collective we. And as a result, we end up with these very, very perverted social institutions, right? Public education becomes privatized. Policing becomes privatized. Military can become privatized. The public defender system becomes privatized. All of these entities become privatized and therefore less regulated. That's how you end up with an emergency manager in Michigan,
yeah,
who's overseeing this, as opposed to an actual politician who's accountable to the people. In the name of efficiency, you have a public defense. You have a system of pleas, as opposed to trials in the court system, which leads to a lack of access to the public of what's true and what's good. Everything is privatized, and so again, all the market logic prevails. And this doesn't just compromise the well-being of Black people, although we're disproportionately affected by this. It compromises the life chances and prosperity of white citizens. One, at the level of political organizing, right? You have a figure who can come in. Let's say hypothetically, there's a demagogue like presidential figure who emerges, who convinces white voters to vote against their own interests by convincing them that the boogeyman is not the economic situation that they're facing, but that it's some immigrant or some Muslim or some Arab who's coming and destroying the America that we have, and we need to long for the nostalgic days of America, of an American yesterday. Year that never existed, right? I mean, imagine if that happened in America. That's possible, and it's entirely plausible. And I think it happens because we're so confused about what the source of our problems are that we turn on each other as opposed to turning to each other and organizing together.
Mark Lamont Hill, I think we're a nation founded on nobler ideals than that.
I agree with you, sir. I want to find that America, sir. I want to make it great again.
So much of your book really has to do with agency, and I think that, you know, as someone who's really studied the plight of Black America, you're very skillful at demonstrating the extent to which erasure is so possible when big meritocratic forces like capitalism, like white supremacy, are brought to bear on a vulnerable population. And I think there's a trace you make through Black codes to redlining to emergency management in Flint that's pretty compelling. Do you think that in the end, what we're seeing emerging here on the streets of America is perhaps a defiant and maybe lasting assertion of Black agency now?
You know, I think there's at every moment, and I say this at the end of the book, as you know, that at every moment where there's been oppression, there's been resistance. There's never been a moment where we have been called nobody by the state, where we haven't asserted our somebodyness, whether it's Sojourner Truth saying, "Ain't I a woman?" you know, speaking back to white feminism, that white feminism, white liberal feminism that dehumanized them, you know. You know, whether it's, you know, Jesse Jackson in the 70s saying, I am somebody, whether it's the I am a man signs of the 1960s, the Alcatraz prisoners saying we are men, or right now people asserting that Black Lives Matter. We've always offered that kind of resistance. And I think this moment is breeding yet another iteration of that. Whether it's lasting or not, I think, is a challenge. I think there are forces that often seduce us into thinking that the progress that we've achieved make these types of resistance movements less necessary. You know, the advances of the 1960s and 1970s, you know, you get past, you know, public accommodations of 64 or voting rights of 65. And, you know, there's almost like a Faustian bargain that's made between the black middle class and the poor, where suddenly the black middle class have access to Harvard and Yale and, you know, access to nice institutions and good neighborhoods. And the black poor get really thrown under the proverbial bus. This is a kind of moment that happens. And then we reignite our radical energies, you know, at different moments. I think this is our generation's radical moment. I think August 9th, 2014 was the moment where once again that defiance that you talk about gets spotlighted again, where the resistance becomes more concentrated. I hope that it's long-lasting. I hope that it lasts forever, or at least until we can produce a different kind of social reality. But there's always a chance that once again we'll get comfortable, that some concessions will be made, that we'll get a nice liberal president like a Hillary Clinton or a Barack Obama who will make us think that we've made significant progress because we have a new driver, even though the bus is going in the same direction. Mm-hmm. So what I would encourage us to do is continue to think and continue to read and continue to organize and continue to struggle so that we not only have a moment of resistance, but we have a movement of resistance that doesn't stop.
Mark Lamont Hill, declining the beer summit invitation. Thank you so much for being with us. The book is called Nobody: Casualties of America's War on the Vulnerable, from Ferguson
it's great.
To Flint and beyond. It's a great book.
We read it yesterday. Yeah, and Mark, we miss you so much, and it's so good to talk to you.
I miss you guys, and I'll have a beer summit with you guys. I'm going to come to D.C., and let's just get drunk.
Yes.
It's a date, man. It's a date.
Yes.
All right, Mark, thanks so much. And we're back. Folks, by the time you hear this podcast, the Olympic Games in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, will have kicked off. And so will a lot of people been kicked off of the land they own and the homes they live in. And here to talk about that, we have Zach Carter.
Hi.
And our man in the sports world of misery, Travis Waldron.
Can I change that to my official title?
Yes, yeah, it should be on your card. The sports world of misery with Travis Waldron. It's very terrible. So we've had, Travis, you've been on the show a bunch of times talking about the Olympics, which I gather you do not have a particularly fond opinion of. But one of the things that you've been more laser focused on now is how the Olympics as an institution, maybe not just in Brazil, but elsewhere, has really disproportionately impacted poor homeowners in host cities.
Yeah, that's correct. And, you know, there's a community in Rio de Janeiro called Via Autodromo that has garnered a lot of international focus because it has largely been destroyed to make way for the Olympics. It's less than a mile from the Olympic Park in Rio. It's very close to a lot of the major venues. And at first, they said they were going to let them stay. And then they came back in the years before the games and said, hold on, we need this area for access roads to the Olympic venues, and you have to go. There were more than, I think, 650 families there, and they finally struck a deal earlier this summer that 25 are going to be able to remain. So, you know, more than 90% of those families have been relocated, and most of them against their will. Some of them have received compensation, and, you know, some of them left voluntarily because they saw the writing on the wall, but the majority of them wanted to stay. And Autodromo is a favela, so it's a low-income neighborhood that, you know, those are they're complex neighborhoods. They're not slums, as a lot of people categorize them. They're home to millions of Rio citizens. Autodromo is one of the smallest ones, but it was a place that a lot of people wanted to remain and weren't allowed to. And the thing is while it's gotten a lot of attention, this isn't a unique situation in Brazil. It happens at almost every Olympics.
And would you go so far as to say that the Olympics almost intentionally exists to do this to poor neighborhoods? Because at a certain point, when you do it again and again and again, you see the same kind of economic impact you're having. If you don't arrest,
and Jason Cherkis wrote a story about this for like the Village Voice,
right?
In 1996.
When it happened in Atlanta, yeah. and that's what we went back again and looked at Atlanta. The researchers that I've talked to, the people who follow this, activist academics, which is funny because a lot of the academics who study the Olympics tend to turn into major Olympic critics, if not activists against them. But it's they'll say that the process is fairly similar. There's wrinkles in each city based on the local context, but the process tends to follow a similar path. And it's hard when you look at the last 7 or 8 Olympics, particularly the summer versions, to say that it isn't at least a somewhat deliberate product of the games rather than a kind of unfortunate, this community got in the way and we had to do, redevelopment to host this major event. When you look at who benefits, which are developers and, politicians who those developers prefer and the international sporting world, and you look at who is affected, which is almost always the urban poor.
Yeah.
And it happens 7, 8, 10 times in a row.
It does seem
to connect the dots.
The sun does rise this morning. I think the sun's going to rise again the next morning. I can't prove it.
Right.
It seems likely.
Is all of sports, professional sports, just now becoming like a really gross economic boondoggle? Because here in America, we see people get taken for a ride by professional sports organizations all the time. In Atlanta, they've built a new baseball stadium, and it was sort of like jacked over the people who lived in Atlanta. There's a boondoggle unfolding in Arlington, Texas right now with the new Texas Ranger Stadium. Their current stadium is only 22 years old. It was built to be like this grand old-fashioned style ballpark. Mm-hmm. People still love going there, and now they want to build a new stadium and completely with a completely different modern type theme. And I believe that the way the financing really looks when you cut down on the fine print is that area taxpayers are going to be on the hook for like some 80% of the cost of the stadium.
Always the way that works,
right? And it's the same with the Olympics. The Olympics come. The reason that Boston ultimately rejected the Olympics is because they make you sign a provision that's called a taxpayer guarantee, where you step in to cover the cost if private financing or Olympic-related revenues fall short. And and that's the thing.
That's never happened. Right. Cost overruns.
And that's
the
thing is I talked to this one researcher who studied the games in Sydney and Vancouver, and she basically said, "Look, this is taxpayer financed." Boondoggle that also, when you get out of the theory element of it, when you get out of it doesn't make up its cost, this is bad for your city's economy, when you step away from kind of the academic paper economics, it has a very obvious negative effect on poor people.
I mean, your taxpayers are effectively paying money to kick poor people out of their homes so that rich people can watch games on TV
for 2 weeks.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the thing is, but if you look at these communities, they're all almost they're different because they're in different countries and different cities, but they share very similar aspects that make them kind of ripe for this. You look in Atlanta, the community, the major housing project that was torn down to make way for the games was wedged between Georgia Tech and downtown Atlanta, where they built the Olympic Park. In Rio, it's wedge between a major highway and where they're building all the Olympic venues, across a lagoon from one of the fastest growing, wealthiest areas of Rio. They're kind of these small isolated communities. This happened in London too.
Yeah.
And they're places that developers and politicians have targeted for removal before, have not really been able to get that done because the political will isn't necessarily there. And then all of a sudden the Olympics come to town
and it puts
and we've got to get this done. Yeah. Or in Atlanta, it's, is this really what you want in the international tourist community and all these athletes to see? And so, you know, one, a researcher from Georgia Tech who studied the effects of the Olympics in Atlanta told me, quote, "The Olympics provided the cover for the destruction of these neighborhoods."
Basically, yeah.
And, you know, it's eventually, I think we've, you know, we've had so many talks. There's so much discussion now about the cost of the games. And that's good because it's spiraled out of control. But the effects of those costs also have to be looked at. What we're doing with that
right.
money, what
right.
that money is doing.
It's not just the taxpayers are ponying up money, it's that they're, right. they're actively doing harm to these communities.
Right.
It is true that the promise, the games make a lot of outlandish promises. I know that there have been people here in Washington, D.C. who have courted the Olympic Games, and they've tried to sell it to a skeptical community as this is how you get your metro improvements. This is how you get your commute improvements. And I've always said, if we're all in agreement that these things need improved,
just do
what
them.
The fuck do we need an Olympics
just
to,
do them.
To do it for?
Right.
Well, all an Olympics is going to do is hit us with staggering cost right. overruns that will prevent us from solving these problems that they don't solve.
And Rio's a great example of this because you know they had the World Cup and the Olympics back-to-back. It came with billions of infrastructure promises. Well, when the World Cup came, there were all these delays in construction on the venues. Well, you can't have a World Cup without the stadiums. So if you're down to a year to finish everything you need for the World Cup, you're not going to finish the infrastructure. You're not going to finish the new roads and the new bus lanes and the new metro lines. You're going to finish the stadiums. And then they have an Olympics 2 years later. Well, now they've got to get all that done. You know, so we're seeing they've done some of it, you know. But again, the question is, why did you need an Olympics to do that? And it's interesting that you brought up D.C. because if you actually look at what the people who wanted to bring the Olympics to D.C. said, it was, these are communities where they were going to put the games, which is in the southeast mm-hmm. part of the city along the Anacostia River. These are communities that need our redevelopment resources. These are the communities that need our help. And it's like, but if you look at all the past Olympics, you're making the communities nicer. The buildings look great.
Yeah.
But the people who were there before the games are not the same people who were there after the games.
No, you're so right. you're going to kick them all out.
You didn't improve their lives.
Yeah.
You're
yeah.
just sending everybody to PG County.
Exactly. Exactly. Happened. Has there been an Olympics that has gotten this right? I know it's a tough question.
I think the one that through the research, Barcelona didn't do as many kind of forcible evictions. I don't think Barcelona actually did any forcible evictions, but there were still some like post-Olympic gentrification effects.
How did Barcelona manage to not?
Barcelona didn't build that much. They kind of used it as a, they kind of, from my understanding, put it in an area of town that wasn't really developed, but also wasn't really home to very many people. And
it's also an old city with actual cool landmarks that you don't want to destroy.
Yeah.
You know, it's DC, whatever.
I mean, it is really sad that this is like always the backdrop against these Olympics because, of course, we love watching. I love watching, you know, the competition, and I grow to like some of the athletes, and the athletes become sort of complicit in this kind of mess.
Yeah, but you know, the Washington Post had an interesting story over the past week pointing out that the athletes often don't really get paid very well for this. I mean, mm-hmm. they are living yeah. in a lot of cases hand to mouth while the Olympic leaders and developers are getting rich.
Yeah. I mean, that's I mean, people can't appreciate it because I think we celebrate American athletes and we see them on Wheaties boxes and we see them in sponsorships. But a right. lot of these athletes who travel to these games, they're broke and this is their one shot. And, you know, they're not all going to win medals and become Nike heroes. So it's really kind of like a bad stew for everyone involved.
I think it's just important to understand that these things have an effect every single time. And so we've got to do better.
Really quick, why not have a fixed venue for the Olympics for in perpetuity? Stick them in Athens, let them be there forever.
Can you remove everything the IOC and developers and the people who finance these things like about the Olympics?
The backsheesh.
It's a great thing to do in theory. It's just that nobody who runs this thing would want to do that.
All right. Well, yeah. Sorry. I'm always trying to shut down cons instead of propping them up. That's just my way. All right, Travis. You're going to Brazil in a week.
I am.
All right. Well, enjoy your time there. Do not catch Zika if you can avoid it.
Don't drink the water.
Don't swim.
Shit.
We look forward to hearing you talk about what it was like to be there. Cool. We will be right back. Thanks. Hello, we are back. 2 years ago, ISIS forces surrounded an area in Iraq called Mount Sinjar, where they laid siege to a unique group of people within the Kurdistan region of Iraq called the Yazidis. This was a flashpoint moment, both publicly in the conflict with ISIS. Rescuing the Yazidis became the first major task of the Obama administration when they decided to get involved in this conflict. 2 years on, we're looking at a situation in which ISIS appears to be in retreat, but still quite entrenched in power. We're joined now to talk about the time period and what we're looking at now, 2 years after the world first decided that this was a serious conflict that needed to be taken seriously. Akbar Ahmed, 3 weeks in a row.
Hi.
It's so great to have you here.
Thank you.
To talk about foreign policy. We're very lucky to have you. We're also extremely fortunate to have on the line by phone Bayan Sami Abdurrahman. She is Kurdistan's foreign minister to the United States. Bayan, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome, but you just promoted me. I'm not foreign minister. I'm the representative.
Thank you for joining us. And I wanted to just begin by asking you to set the stage for us 2 years ago with what happened in Mount Sinjar. And who are the Yazidis as an ethnic population? Because this is a very fascinating subgroup living within Iraq's borders.
What happened was that in August 2014, on August the 3rd, ISIS attacked Sinjar. Sinjar is a very large district. It's actually all of the districts is about the size of Lebanon. But within that district, there are villages, there's the town of Sinjar itself, and there is Mount Sinjar, which is a very long mountain. It's not a mountain with a peak. It's kind of a very long undulating mountain. The Yazidis are Kurds ethnically, but their religion, unlike most Kurds, is not Muslim. The Yazidis are Yazidi, that is the name of their faith. It predates Islam, but also takes bits and pieces from Islam as well. For us, as a community in Kurdistan, the Yazidis are respected, and they're part of our community. Their holy books and so on are written in the Kurdish language. So the Yazidis are largely in the Sinjar area of Iraq. And what happened was that in August 2014, ISIS attacked the Yazidis. Now, when we say ISIS, we mean not just the foreign fighters. We mean also locals. And this is what's heartbreaking for the Yazidis. Many of their Arab neighbors that they had lived with for years, turned against them, raped their daughters, beheaded their sons, enslaved women and children, and even today, more than 3,200 Yazidi women and girls are sexually enslaved by ISIS. So ISIS came in these sort of mad kamikaze suicide missions on tanks that they had just captured in Mosul, Humvees, heavy weapons, and used them to terrorize the community and drove hundreds of thousands of them to Mount Sinjar, and that is where they took refuge. Others who couldn't escape were massacred. We know there are many, many mass graves. Many have been discovered, but there are others that we can see from satellite imagery. The village of Kojo, the entire village has either been wiped out by that, I mean killed, or they have fled, and very, very few survivors exist from that village. So this is what happened in August 2014. Fortunately, and we are forever grateful to President Obama, fortunately, the United States decided to order airstrikes against ISIS around August the 7th or 8th. And around that time, the airstrikes began against ISIS, pushing them back. The U.S., other countries, and Iraqi Air Force as well began airlifts and airdrops of food and aid to the Yazidis who were stranded on Mount Sinjar. Mount Sinjar became a safe haven for the Yazidis, but also a kind of a valley of death, if I can call it that, because people were trapped there in the August heat, and this is sweltering heat. Women, and particularly children and the elderly, died on Mount Sinjar because there was no food, no water. They couldn't get down off the mountain. They were trapped there. So this is what happened in August 2014, and we, as in the Kurdistan Regional Government, but also the people of Kurdistan, and especially the Yazidi community, are marking this black anniversary, and we're calling for justice. We are asking that those perpetrators of this genocide against the Yazidis and other minorities, the Christians in Iraq, other minorities as well, these criminals should be brought to justice.
And Bayan, could you update us on the current status now of Yazidi refugees, people who fled that region within the Kurdistan Regional Government? Where are they? Where are the camps? How is rehabilitation for them going? And I know Kurdistan is involved with trying to get some of these Yazidi women back from Daesh, the ones who have been sexually enslaved. What's going on with those efforts? What are the successes? What are the challenges?
Well, what we're trying to do is we are really lobbying governments around the world, starting with the United States, but also Britain, France, other countries. We're lobbying them to convince them that there should be a kind of an investigative commission that will investigate the crimes of Daesh, ISIS, will keep that evidence so that one day there can be a prosecution. Now, that prosecution could be through the International Criminal Court, the ICC, or maybe a new kind of special international tribunal. But also, we can at the same time have local justice. We can also have courts in Kurdistan, in Iraq, try the thousands of people. It's not just a handful. It's thousands of people, many of them locals, who have raped, who have looted, who have pillaged, who were even today holding people enslaved in their own homes. So we're looking for justice and accountability on two fronts. One is local, but also for the leaders of Daesh, the leaders of ISIS, to be tried at a global level, because the crimes that they've committed are of such magnitude that they warrant an international response.
Kurdistan has obviously had a lot of success in repelling ISIS, but as a sort of like quasi-nation state, it occupies a very sort of tense position in the world, where there's, you know, rivalries between the Turks to the north and Sunni and Shia populations in Iraq. Do you believe that Kurdistan can continue to play a major role against ISIS while sort of tripping through all the wires of these international relationships?
Well, I think we, by necessity, have become expert at negotiating these tripwires that you described.
Yeah.
Because we just have to. We are in a very tough neighborhood. We have neighbors like Iran, like Turkey, like Saudi Arabia. Syria is also on the border with Kurdistan, Iraqi Kurdistan. So this is the neighborhood that we're in. Iran is not just a regional player, it's an international player. Turkey has the second largest army in NATO after the United States. So we have to navigate these very rough, choppy waters all the time. And through necessity, we have developed ways and means of doing this. We do our best to maintain a very good relationship with Iran, to maintain a good relationship with Turkey. These relationships have a different character. With Turkey, the relationship is much more based around the economy. We export oil through Turkey, and one day we hope to export gas to Turkey. With Iran, our relationship is much more nuanced, it's much more diplomatic, and we try to have what we consider to be a correct relationship with Iran. So this is the neighborhood that we're in, but it's the fact that all of those neighbors and the United States, Europe, they need Kurdistan to fight Daesh. They need the Peshmerga. It's been acknowledged by many leaders, including Secretary Carter, that the Peshmerga are the most effective ground force against Daesh. And I have to say that it's been at great sacrifice.
Yeah.
More than 1,500 Peshmerga have been killed and more than 8,000 wounded.
How would you – obviously, we're marking a very black anniversary. How would you say things have proceeded in the 2 years since? Here in America, our government tells us constantly that ISIS is in retreat, that there's no quick fixes, of course, and that it's not going to be something that's dealt with overnight. But we get an optimistic view that they're in retreat, they've lost territory, that the situation is still very tense in Syria because of the ongoing internecine conflicts there with the Assad regime. But we're given a sort of like hopeful and quasi optimistic view of that conflict. As someone who is more familiar with the situation at ground level, how would you describe it?
I think that actually that assessment is correct. We have defeated Daesh on many fronts militarily. So right now, the Peshmerga still have a 1,000-kilometer front line against ISIS, about 600-kilometer front line. But whenever the Peshmerga have gained ground, whenever we've taken ground, we've been able to hold it. Of course, ISIS continually attacks, but we have been able to hold the ground. And increasingly, we're seeing the Iraqi security forces do the same. At the beginning, the Iraqi security forces were disastrous, catastrophic. When Daesh entered Mosul in June 2014, the Iraqi forces abandoned everything and handed over helicopters, tanks, Humvees, heavy weapons to ISIS. But since then, and particularly more recently, we've seen the Iraqi security forces, for example, take Fallujah back and hold it. And so I think it is correct to say that ISIS is on the retreat. In Syria, they are also being surrounded. With regards to Iraq, we and the Iraqi forces and the coalition forces, we are together increasingly surrounding Mosul so that we're preparing the ground for the day that Mosul can be liberated. Where I think we and the international coalition need to do much, much more is actually on the humanitarian front. The war with ISIS has created a humanitarian crisis in Iraq that the United Nations designates to be level three. Level three means this is life and death, everybody mobilize. Well, it's been a level three crisis for 2 years.
Yeah.
It's unsustainable. And those very Yazidis and Christians that I was talking about who 2 years ago had to flee their homes, flee for their lives, 2 years later, they're still living in camps. The lucky ones are living in camps. The others are living, some of them in the roadside, some in half-finished buildings. Others who may be better off have been able to rent apartments and share apartments. Sometimes you're getting four or five families sharing a two-bedroom apartment because that's the only way they can manage. And the United Nations is struggling to raise money for the humanitarian crisis in Iraq. So I would say militarily we are getting there. But on the humanitarian front, the catastrophe is there. And it's a ticking time bomb. Why? Because of the young generation. We have yet another generation of young Iraqis, whether they're Christian, Yazidi Kurds, Turkmen, Shia, Sunni. We have another generation whose education is almost zero. We have another generation who are growing up in this kind of marginalized, vulnerable environment. And what does that tell us about the future of Iraq?
Yeah.
Just
a final question on the Yazidi community's specific kind of resettlement 2 years on from this genocide. You talked, Bayan, about international justice. What other needs are we hearing that are going unmet from Yazidi communities? I mean, how much are people talking about wanting to move back to ancient ancestral lands or homes? Or is there still fear of going back, even if ISIS is removed? What's going on with the community and their future specifically?
Well, you've really hit the nail on the head. The community does want to go back. Nobody wants to live in this hand-to-mouth situation as a displaced person. And being displaced is the same as being a refugee, in that you've lost absolutely everything. It's just that the terminology is different because refugees and displaced people have a different legal status. So absolutely, people want to go back home. They want to go back to their farmlands. They want to go back to their villages. If they're a teacher, they want to go back to their job. If they're a doctor, they want to go back to their hospital and serve their community again. But with the destruction of Sinjar, it's impossible. Sinjar is absolutely rubble. It's, you know, if you can imagine, Berlin or Germany after the immediate ceasefire of the Second World War, where everything was just rubble, this is what Sinjar looks like. So the people can't go back because we don't even have basic services like water and electricity and, you know, refuse collection or so on, wastewater collection. We don't have anything like that. So people want to go back, but they can't go back because of the destruction, and they also can't go back because nobody feels that it's safe right now. And this is why we need to finish the job and liberate Mosul and drive ISIS out of Iraq.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for joining us on the show today. And please feel free to come back on. We love talking about this stuff, and we like to bring this kind of news to our listeners. It's very unique. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Bob.
We will be right back. So that's what happened this week. This podcast was produced, edited, and engineered by Christine Canetta. Our executive producer is Nick Offenberg. I'm Jason Linkins. This week, we were joined by journalist and author Mark Lamont Hill, the Kurdistan Regional Government's representative to the United States, Bayan Sami Abdulrahman, as well as Huffington Post reporters Akbar Ahmed, Zach Carter, Arthur Delaney, and Travis Waldron. So That Happened is available on iTunes at itunes.com/sothathappened. Check out the whole family of Huffington Post podcasts in the iTunes store. And while you're there, subscribe and tell your friends. If there's something you'd like to hear us talk about, send an email to sothathappened@huffingtonpost.com. Thanks to all of you for listening. We miss you already.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out for a chance to win the French Open title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV, live in HD. Don't miss a moment with daily live coverage and match replays on demand, beginning Monday, May 20th. Be there for all the unforgettable moments. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus.